ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
No one loves the coast more than us Australians, and the vast majority of us, of course, live close to the ocean. We know all about the coastline. We cherish it. It's become precious, depending on where you look. Around 80 to 85% of Australia's population are coast dwellers. But with all of us clustering together along the outermost edges of the country, there comes a huge environmental impact, as you'd know. Now, for years, industry, recreation, travel and agriculture has been taking a toll on coastal ecosystems, and with not a lot of mind given as to the long-term consequences. Although that thinking is changing, the state of the environment is becoming a lot more important to a lot more people. And a greater emphasis is being placed on how to restore and protect our coastal ecosystems. Now, there's not one single solution, as we know. It's a massive and a multifaceted issue, but it does mean that bringing back healthy coastal habitats requires a lot of cooperation and will. You might be involved in coastal restoration projects yourself and would like to join this conversation tonight. I thought we'd look and take a closer look at coastal restoration projects from a couple of different angles and why they're so important and how they all complement each other. We're joined by a terrific panel tonight. We've got Dr. Michael Sivers from Griffith University on the Gold Coast. Michael's a marine ecologist with the university's Global Wetlands Project. Much of his work looks at how animal populations are affected by coastal restoration efforts and the role that animals play in these ecosystems. Michael, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Lovely to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us as well. And also to the rest of our panel as well. We're joined by CSIRO's Senior Research Scientist, Dr. Megan Saunders. Now, Megan's based in Hobart. She's a coastal ecological modeller and looks at the drivers of change in marine ecosystems, what it actually takes to get projects off the ground. Megan, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, Philip. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's terrific to have you with us. Also joining us tonight with her expertise is Associate Professor Dr. Fernanda Adame, also from Griffith University but based in Brisbane. Fernanda's area of expertise is coastal ecosystems and how they interact and process things like carbon and nitrogen, as well as the markets that have grown out of capitalising on these processes as well. Fernanda, good to have your time and expertise. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Philip. Happy to be here.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you with us. Look, Michael, can we start with you? When we talk about coastal habitats, what are we talking about here?
Well, I mean, there is a really large diversity of different coastal habitat types. Our group in particular, we work on what we sometimes refer as coastal wetlands. So we're really focused on six key habitats. So that's mangrove forests, seagrass meadows, salt marshes, shellfish reefs, so typically oysters and mussels,
yep,
coral reefs, and also macroalgae reefs, and they're sometimes called kelp forests. But of course, you know, there's other coastal systems, sandy beaches, mudflats, rocky reefs, and many others. I'm sure we could sit down and come up with another dozen or so. So quite the diversity of ecosystem types along our coasts.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we're well aware of the Great Barrier Reef, for example, and you know all the problems of that, and that's not really in the scope of tonight's discussion, really. But you know, we often forget about the actual coastline itself and what's happening there, don't we?
We do, and sometimes some of these habitats we focus on are called sort of the poor cousins, if you will, of coral reefs.
Yeah.
Who get, you know, their lion's share of the news and funding and things like that.
Yes, exactly. Your research focuses largely on the animal side of things. Tell me about that. I mean, and tell me about the animal populations we're talking about. What sort of populations?
So, really, any species is what I'm interested in that occupies these habitats or can have some sort of benefit for them. Our group really does have a bit of a big focus on fishes and crustaceans, and that's because these are really ecologically important, but obviously there's also an economic sort of side to fisheries and things like that.
Yeah. Go on.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say that when we restore these habitats, you know, they're really readily occupied by a whole suite of different taxonomic groups.
Mm.
And each different taxonomic group can benefit that system in many different ways.
What's the state of the crustacean load, as it were, in Australia. Do we have any idea? I remember having similar discussions in the past about the state of the insect load, for example. I mean insects on land. Yep. We've talked about frogs in the past too, and the great concern about the numbers of frogs, and then the difficulty of actually measuring these things. And some people say it's not as bad as we think. With crustaceans, we're talking what, crabs and shellfish and all and everything else. What's the state of the shellfish? What's the state of the crustacean load, as it were, on our coastlines? Is it in trouble? Is it doing reasonably well? How would you classify it?
I would classify it as data deficient. So I would, when we're talking about...
We don't know, in other words.
Yeah. I just don't think we've been monitoring these sorts of species for as long as we have for things like frogs. Obviously, it's a lot more difficult for many reasons to monitor population sizes in aquatic environments. But equally as important, and yes, as you say, what we normally think of when we think of crustaceans is these big crabs and these big prawns that some people like to eat.
Yeah.
But there's a massive, I'd argue, a greater population of much smaller crustaceans, things like amphipods and isopods that some people might not have ever heard of that play really fundamentally important ecological roles in these systems.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, much as we've talked about the role of frogs, sorry about returning to land, we'll get to the coast in a moment, but that these smaller animals are often seen as, the canaries in the coal mine of environmental change and catastrophic environmental change. Is that how we look at the coastline when we're looking at small crustaceans?
Yes, I'd say probably equally with respect to, I guess, what we might call the macrofauna, so the bigger species, both of which obviously have, again, really fundamental roles in the system. But I think it would be easier to not notice declines in these less conspicuous, smaller species.
Yeah, I remember foraging with my dad when he was a science teacher at high school. He had a great fascination with rock pools. And as a kid, I spent a huge amount of time. You probably have done the same.
I can totally relate to that.
We spent a huge amount of time fossicking around rock pools, and I learnt, as much as a kid was going to learn about anemones and small crabs. Fortunately, we never came across a blue-ringed octopus, but we did come across some small ones.
Absolutely. In a past life, I researched benthic sessile organisms, so I'm quite fond of the invertebrates and the tiny little animals that not many people notice.
Yeah. What's the message coming back from rock pools and rock pool foragers? Is there still the same amount of life in them?
That's a really good question, and I honestly don't know the answer. I'm sure in some places, particularly heavily urbanised and tourist hotspots, the answer would almost certainly be no.
Yeah.
They're not what they used to be. And then in other areas, Australia still has some lovely, pristine sort of beachy, intertidal rocky areas where I'm sure the rock pools are very healthy still.
Mm. Yeah, indeed. We're talking about protecting our coastline. We've got Dr. Michael Sivers, we're talking to at the moment, a marine ecologist from Griffith University. Let's bring in Fernanda Adame. Dr. Fernanda Adame is an associate professor at Griffith University. Fernanda, something we're seeing more of in the news is how important coastal ecosystems are when it comes to carbon sequestration. Tell me about that. What's carbon sequestration in relation to the coastline about anyway?
So carbon sequestration, we have an excess of CO2 in the atmosphere, and the only way to transform that carbon dioxide is through photosynthesis. And plants can do this, as we all know. They convert this carbon dioxide into plant biomass. It could be leaves, twigs, or woody biomass. And coastal wetlands are especially good at this because they don't only absorb a lot of this CO2, they grow really fast, but also they accumulate a lot of that carbon in their soils. And because there's very low oxygen conditions in the soil, that makes it very stable, that carbon. So we can be stored there for hundreds or even thousands of years. That's why this blue carbon ecosystem is mangroves, salt marshes, seagrasses, and other tidal wetlands that have this capacity of taking a lot of carbon and then storing them for long periods of time.
Mm. It's not just excess carbon that coastal ecosystems process too. Nitrogen's another big one, doesn't it? Where does excess nitrogen come from, or is it all from land-based fertilizers and runoff, is it?
Yeah, so mostly, so naturally, our planet was very deficient in nitrogen. We did, you know, like life, when life started on the planet, there was a problem because there was not enough nitrogen. And what happens is there's only one way to transform the nitrogen that's in the air, which is actually very abundant, to ways that plants and animals can consume it. And this can only be done by some specific bacteria. However, humans were able to sort out these problems, and they found a way of chemically using the air to make nitrogen that can be used by crops. And that's the way we produce fertilizers now. The problem is that now we have twice as much nitrogen produced by fertilizers than what we have naturally. So when we have the, obviously fertilizers was amazing for human development, and because it allows us to have food. But then a lot of the misuse of fertilizers resulted in almost 40% of the fertilizers we use is actually not used by the crops, but is, you know, put into waterways and ends up in the ocean and cause a lot of problems with water quality, as such as algal blooms or areas of low oxygen.
Yeah.
So it's actually now we have too much CO2 in the air and too much nitrogen in the water.
What's the role of nitrogen in the water anyway, or is it just a problem?
Oh no, we need nitrogen to live. All our proteins in our body, our DNA, our amino acids, it's made of nitrogen. So and life needs nitrogen. It's just now that we have too much nitrogen. So when you have too much, it means that it favors some organisms like green algae.
Yep.
And it pretty much outcompetes everything. That's when you go swimming in a lake and it's all green. And, you know, it's like nobody wants to swim there. It looks disgusting. It probably has too much nitrogen. And that's what's causing that this algae to take over.
How do you get rid of it out of a coastal environment?
Well, that's why, in this case, coastal wetlands have become so important. Because in one side, they sequester all this carbon, which is good for our climate. But they also have this capacity, which they have this microbes in the soil, which can do exactly the opposite of what we do when we create fertilizers, which is transform that nitrogen into gas.
Right.
So they basically release it back where it came from. That process is called denitrification. So that's why a lot of places, even water treatment plants now, they have wetlands where they discharge the water because they know that after it comes out of the wetlands, it's going to come much cleaner.
Okay, so it's high in nitrogen. It goes into the wetland, and just go over that again. What happens to the nitrogen in the wetland? What comes out the other end?
Oh, it just comes less nitrogen because these bacteria take that nitrogen in the water and convert it to gas.
Okay.
So yeah, so they basically can consume.
What sort of gases are we talking about here, Fernet?
So it's mostly nitrogen gas, which is natural. It's like 80% of the atmosphere is made of nitrogen.
Okay.
So it's really just normal nitrogen. A little bit of it comes as nitrous oxide, which is the one that we don't want.
Because
that one, it's a greenhouse gas. But it's depending on the conditions of the wetland, sometimes but it's really like 1% of the nitrogen, it will be nitrous oxide. The rest would just be normal, harmless nitrogen gas.
Mm. Yes, fascinating. Dr. Fernanda Adame is with us from Griffith University, Michael Sivers as well, also from Griffith. We're talking about how we care for our coastline and what we do about restoring coastlines as well. We're also joined by Megan Saunders, who's a senior research scientist with the CSIRO. Megan, getting everything, all your ducks in a row when you're trying to approach coastal restoration is difficult, isn't it? I mean, you have to get everyone to agree, or they have to get everyone to collaborate.
Yeah, so coastal and marine ecosystem restoration is really challenging, but I think it's pretty clear from listening to Fernanda and Michael, it's also really, really important. We've lost a huge number of our coastal assets, Here in Tasmania, where I live, we've lost 95% of giant kelp beds. We've lost around 90% of some of the shellfish reefs around southern Australia. And when we lose those habitats, we lose all of the important functions and services and the kind of spiritual and cultural values that we associate with those habitats. So there's lots of groups around Australia who are doing amazing work to try and rebuild these ecosystems. But as you mentioned, it's not without its challenges. So my research program and with my collaborators, we're really trying to develop the science and to work with a huge number of partners to think about how we can scale up marine and coastal restoration over larger scales. And we want to do that because we want to help rebuild these habitats, make them more resilient, and bring back those ecosystem services and functions, things like supporting biodiversity, supporting nutrient filtration, and helping our society to mitigate and adapt to climate change.
Talk to me about the big kelp forests in Tassie. I mean, these are world famous, aren't they? There's a forest of giant kelp, massive great things, which grow from the surface of the ocean all the way down to the bottom of the ocean, often many meters tall, huge great things, and the kelp forests were once thick with fish and all sorts of wildlife. They've been devastated. Do we know why, and how might we restore them?
The giant kelp beds are absolutely magical environments. I would really encourage anyone, if they get the chance, to hop on a boat or in the water with them, to absolutely do it. They're this beautiful three-dimensional structure that support this huge biodiversity. Here in Tasmania, the loss of giant kelp has been primarily driven by warming water temperatures, which is allowing a sea urchin from the mainland to expand its range southward. That sea urchin can then graze over kelp beds. Kelp, like other ecosystems, are lost for a variety of reasons. But the thing is, with these losses of ecosystems, we can't actually take actions to make a difference and to recover them. There's amazing work happening in Tasmania to really pioneer approaches to restoring lost giant kelp habitats. And across our ecosystems, there's all of these different types of approaches being taken to develop the science and to rebuild different types of ecosystems. So I think, we do hear a lot of doom and gloom in the environment space about loss and decline, but there are really exciting actions that are being taken.
But with the kelp beds, though, is the loss of kelp entirely attributable to permanent changes in water temperature, or do we know exactly why kelp beds have been lost?
So, like many habitats, death by a thousand cuts kind of comes into play here, but we'll see it kind of a combination of what we call local and global stressors impacting kelp beds. So the research shows that when you have really strong kind of marine protected areas or kind of enforcement on over extraction, you can get better outcomes. And this is because ecosystems are complex habitats. And when you have animals like lobsters in place that can graze, that can eat the urchins, then those urchins can't damage the kelp bed. But back to your other point, with climate change, there are really big changes happening in our environment. And when we think about restoring coastal and marine ecosystems, we need to really start looking forward to coordinated programs of investment that are keeping these future stressors in mind as well as the ones from the past.
Yes, indeed. All right. Megan Saunders is with us from the CSIRO, Michael Sivers and Fernanda Adame. We're talking about caring for the Australian coastline, the stresses on it, and how we might do things better. Megan, just back to you on this issue of coastlines and the things we do with it. Quite a few people are texting in saying, yes, what about salmon farming going on in Tasmania? I don't want to involve you in what's a pretty hot-blooded controversy, I know, about this. But the plain fact is that kind of aquaculture does have a big impact on the coastal environment, doesn't it?
Look, here in Tasmania, salmon farming is a hugely important industry. Brings in you know, a lot of money for people, and a lot of communities rely on it.
Yeah.
We do know, though, around the world that salmon farming or aquaculture more broadly can have negative environmental outcomes. There are, however, some really exciting ways that we can think about doing aquaculture in ways that are less harmful. So one of those ways is when you actually combine aquaculture of more than one type of organism together. So you might have, say, some finfish that produce nitrogen. Then you have some shellfish and some algae that take that nitrogen and other products out of the water. So I'm really excited about those ideas. The research we're doing more broadly is really looking at the restoration of coastal habitats, which are declining for a number of different reasons. And really what we'd like to see is really coordinated programs of investment into the restoration of marine and coastal ecosystems so that we can really start seeing restoration happening at scale. And by coordinating, we can make sure that resources are used really effectively, that we can avoid negative trade-offs, and we can get portfolios of benefits across different types of projects. So bringing Fernanda and Michael back into the conversation here, if we want to plan all of our restoration projects for carbon, for sort of blue carbon, that will give us co-benefits in other areas, like, say, boosting biodiversity, but it won't give us the same biodiversity as if we planned all our projects for biodiversity outcomes. So when we think about large-scale coordinated programs of investment, we can start thinking about how to plan for the multiple types of benefits that we may want to get from restoration.
Sure. Carol from Taree's given us a call. Hi, Carol.
Oh, hello. I'm very pleased to be able to talk about this tonight. Mm. I'm very concerned about the impact of vehicles going up and down on the beaches. What do they cause the poor little creatures underneath?
You mean in terms of direct damage to the...
Yes, because the beaches used to be fluffy. The sand used to be fluffy. Now it's quite hard like concrete. And I'm sure that vehicles running up and down the beaches like they are roads must have some effect on the little creatures underneath, like the pippies and the worms.
Yeah. Michael, can we bring you in here on this? Michael's a marine ecologist from Griffith University.
Thank you.
I presume, Michael, that none of this is positive, is it?
It's a really good question, and my initial thought was, funnily enough, also the pippies and the sandworms,
yeah.
And there's also some crustaceans that actually live in the more moist sand, amphipods and things like that. And I'm going to be really honest, I do not know if anyone studied the effect of, I guess, compression or driving on the beach and what effect that has on the organisms. Undoubtedly, if they were very close to the surface, I'm sure there could be some sort of impact in terms of, you know, enough impact to affect populations of these species.
But otherwise, we don't really know. Just let me jump in here for a second because I want to introduce some other listeners to the program.
This is Nightlife with Phil Clark
on ABC Radio.
This is Nightlife. We are talking about preparing for our coastline. Michael Sibbers is with us, Dr. Megan Saunders and Dr. Fernanda Adame. Michael was talking just now about the interaction with humans and coastal ecosystems in response to a call from Carol from Taree about the effect of cars on beaches. Michael, I think, you're suggesting, Michael, we don't know enough. Is that it?
Yes, particularly for these small animals that live within the sand, you know, also ghost crabs and things like that. Obviously, there's a risk with respect to birds, lots of shorebirds, especially their chicks and things like that, depending on where they're driving, closer to vegetation or whatnot, and also turtle hatchlings. Not sure they get too many of those in Taree, but I'm not super familiar with that area. But it's definitely an area, I guess, that's ripe for some research on those little guys that don't tend to get as much attention as the turtles and the birds.
Mm. Tell me about the wild animal species you're looking at in your research.
As I said earlier, I'm really interested across every taxonomic group of animals. As an example, I was surveying some restored seagrass in some Danish fjords last year, And we were collecting fish and prawns, snails, crabs, isopods, all sorts of interesting animals that occupy these habitats. Our group more broadly is interested probably in fishes more than anything else. One, because they're a little bit easier to monitor. So we use, we're starting to use underwater cameras, and we're starting to extract information from those videos using artificial intelligence to automate that process. And that's just a little bit more difficult when it comes down to these smaller animals that are a lot harder to see or might be quite cryptic and live within complex structures. But it's almost endless, the diversity of fauna that live within these coastal habitats, much more than you would even imagine just by looking at them.
Here's the thing, isn't it? And you can think about it this way, that actually, I mean, I was reading somewhere the other day that, you know, we shouldn't call our planet Earth because it's not mostly Earth anyway. It's mostly water. We should call the planet ocean because that's what it is. And that's where life, that's where life began, and that's where most life, most biomass is, isn't it?
Indeed, indeed, yes. We are a blue planet.
Yeah. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Text 0467-922-702. Fernanda, bringing you back in here and the involvement of industry. The level of social responsibility that corporations have now when it comes to their environmental impact is known, I suppose. When it comes to something like carbon sequestration, is there a market here that's developed? Are companies interested in investing in it?
Yeah, well, that's actually why I ended up working in carbon and nitrogen. It was not my childhood dream to know the nitrogen cycle very well. But it just happens that that for the first time, it was like one of the services we get from an ecosystem was valued economically. Because beforehand, we used to, you know, everybody wanted to restore this, the mangroves, and we want to restore then conserve these places, but there's really no funding for it. Because what happens is that the governments is the ones that fund the protected areas. But, you know, living in you know, the world we live now, everything is just being driven by markets. So if you own a property, you can do, well, not now anymore, but people used to be able to do whatever they want with that property, and they would just extract things for free, cut the trees for free, extract the water for free. But we realize now, well, that cannot go on because those things are actually not free. They belong to everyone and they have their own right to exist. So the idea of this carbon markets, nitrogen offsets, there's also now biodiversity markets, is that we have to put economic value to these things, and we have to people to pay for them. So if you are cutting a forest, if you are emitting CO2 because you're burning coal, you have to pay for it somehow. And that's why this whole thing became really popular, because people are trying to see, okay, how can we decrease our emissions? And there's many ways of decreasing your emissions, like, for example, fixing some pipes. You can decrease your emissions as you transport coal from one place to another. But you could also restore a mangrove forest, and you will not only get carbon sequestration, but you will get all these other benefits that maybe they're not accounted in that project, but you will still get them. And everyone will receive those benefits, not just the person that's doing the project. So that's why I got really interested in it. And there's definitely a lot of interest in industries to pay for these carbon credits, because there's, well, not only because they want to look good as they have like green credentials, they're looking good that they're doing the right thing, but also because we are demanding more and more of this for these things to happen. We cannot just sit alone and see that what belongs to everyone being destroyed. We want someone to be accountable for it.
Yeah. Hear, hear to that. But, I mean, a lot of people worry, Fernanda, that, you know, if we develop markets like this, we're really allowing companies to have an easy way out. Instead of making efforts to actually reduce emissions, they simply buy their way out of trouble. Do you think that's fair?
Oh, I think it's fair to have concerns, and it's good to have concerns because we have to make them accountable. So there's a lot of safeguards for these things. It's very difficult to create projects. It's not as easy thing. Like people think you can just give accreditation. It's actually a very, very difficult and strict process to get carbon credits for coastal restoration. The other point as well is that it doesn't matter how much we restore, even if we restore all the coastal wetlands in the world, that would only account for 3% of the global emissions.
Yeah.
So there's no way that business can get away without for like reducing their emissions by restoring. So this is definitely not a way out. It's just one complementary action. But as I see it, it's a complementary action that would not only reduce in some reduction of emissions, but we provide a lot of benefits for everyone.
Okay, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Ben from East Hawthorne is with us. G'day, Ben.
Hello.
G'day, Ben. You're on.
Oh, hi. Yeah, thank you. Just a question for the learned professors there in regards to microplastics and microfibers in the oceans and the waterways. When we use desal plants to turn the salt water into drinking water, does that also filter out the microfibers and microplastics?
Good question. Michael, do you know the answer to this? Or Megan, any thoughts here?
We've got some microplastic experts at Griffith University, actually.
Right.
Admittedly, they're more so researching the impacts of those microplastics to animals and humans. So it would just come down to the coarseness of the filters used in the desal process. Mm. I can't say that I'm familiar with those filters. Microplastics can be very, very small, but I imagine salt particles are smaller than the microplastics.
How big is the impact? We read about the impact of microplastics in the ocean generally. I mean, it can make you appalled the more you read about it. But in relation to the coastline and the impact on the coastline, the impact on tiny creatures on our coastline, do we know what microplastics are doing to those ecosystems?
I can't tell you that in mangroves there's a lot of accumulation of plastics because we always see them.
Yeah.
Because that's where the currents go, and they you see all sorts of, like if you go to a place where there's been hurricanes, you find like mattresses in the middle of the forest or like pieces of cars, of everything. But microplastics in general are not as dangerous as people think. But the truth is that we're just starting to understand what are the effects. But I'm not sure what's the effects on the animals. Maybe Michael can tell us more about it.
Because what we're worried about here, Michael, is that we're ingesting microplastics. Every human on the planet is, and every animal in the sea appears to be doing it as well, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So they're finding microplastics, you know, way away from the coast in some pretty deep ocean areas. I'm trying to remember. I read an article about, was it that humans were eating the equivalent of a credit card a year? Don't quote me on that, but
it's something like that. Yeah,
it was something outrageous like that. But yeah, so they're starting to run some experimental trials now. Looking at ingestion of microplastics in fish. I know some jellyfish work, and they are ingesting these things, and sometimes they find negative effects and sometimes they're not finding any ill effects. So definitely an area that just needs a lot more research. It's really been only the last few years that I think interest or concern in microplastics has come to the fore.
All of us, Ben, you probably feel like me. You know, like make a personal war against plastics, do you think?
Indeed. I've got a vested interest because my day job is textile recycling. So we are sort of a little bit across it, and I'm confident that science will help us out to get us out of these issues.
Yeah.
First step is to capture what we can before it gets into the waterways. So that means a lot more filtration in your domestic laundries and stuff like that. I know that Australia is signing up to a treaty by 2030, I believe, I hope it's 2030, not 2040, that there'll be an international standard or treaty or effectiveness to ban or to mitigate as much as possible. I think that we can do stuff now rather than wait. There are tools around, and the great research, we need more of the research, so that we need this research to be continuing so we can get our head around it. But better filtration is probably the easiest and quickest way to implement.
Yeah. Yep, fair enough. Thanks, Ben. And interesting. Look, questions for all three of you about the successes of restoration projects. Megan, some of the biggest challenges when it comes to getting coastal restoration projects off the ground, what are they?
Yeah, coastal and marine ecological restoration can be quite challenging to implement. There's a few reasons for that. Firstly, it's actually quite fascinating that when you go through the permitting process for a lot of these actions, and we might be talking about, you know, planting some plants in an area, or we might be talking about letting the seawater flow back into areas where it had been previously blocked off, or it might be adding like hard substrate back into the ocean where it's just mud right now and the things that like hard substrate can't live there. But the process of doing this involves permits, which it should, because there needs to be checks and balances on these activities. But the permitting process can be really challenging to navigate. It can be really expensive. And the typical number that I hear from a lot of the practitioners who I work with is that it can take, you know, 18, 24, 36 months just to get through the permitting. On top of that, we're pretty new to doing marine and coastal restoration at bigger scales. And so because of this newness, the permitting process that we have isn't fit for purpose for these activities. Sure. So these restoration projects are often being assessed against processes for development. So you might need to go through a development approvals pathway for something like a wetland restoration project, or you might have to go through the Sea Dumping Act for more subtidal projects like coral reef or oysters. So what we would love to see moving forward as we get serious about restoring our marine estate is the development of fit-for-purpose policies that are really designed to make sure that we're avoiding negative outcomes and making sure that, you know, due processes are being followed, but that they're not, it's kind of not a mismatch of the type of activity for the process that it's being assessed against.
Yeah, Michael, do you think we've got to a stage now where we can point to some successes when it comes to restoring populations of species? Do you, and if so, do we know what made it successful? Can you point to some?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of examples of successful restoration projects. Unfortunately, there's a lot of examples of unsuccessful ones too. And interesting, Megan actually wrote a paper a few years ago about, I think it was called, the bright spots of coastal restoration, that highlighted some really successful examples around the world. Here in Australia, the Nature Conservancy is actually doing some great work around restoring lost shellfish reefs, so primarily oysters. I think success, sort of as Megan was saying, comes from this holistic approach, beyond all the issues with, getting permits and the green tape and whatnot. But, considering things like the state of the environment where you're actually planning to restore and mitigating the factors that would likely lead to failures. So the stressors that may have led to that initial degradation that then required you to restore the habitat. If you don't remove that stressor, just because you plant more plants or you add more oysters, the same thing's going to happen, right? And from there all the way up to, the social aspects, like garnering that community support for restoration, you almost need to tick all the boxes to get a successful project. And I think more often than we used to, we're starting to tick all of those boxes.
Yeah, it's pretty depressing, Megan, when you're talking about a whole lot of green tape or red tape, as others in the development industry would say, is basically holding this up. I mean, Michael, do you think we've developed this, a better consciousness. I mean, everyone knows now you shouldn't put untreated wastewater into coastal estuaries and so on. Do you think we've got a better consciousness now of the value of the coastline and what we ought to be putting into it?
I do think that, particularly at the individual level. Yeah. I think our population, especially here in Australia, is quite environmentally conscious. And most of us do the right thing. I think, we've got population growth. And as you say, we all, 80% of us or something like that, live near the coast. And some of those stressors, almost regardless of what the individual does, it's still having a massive impact on the coastal environment. So it's more than just, I guess, individual efforts. It's dramatic, policy changes and, you know, targeting big industries that might be heavy polluters and things like that. I think individually, as I said, I think we're doing a pretty good job here,
yeah,
which is nice to see.
John from Babin Space texting in saying, I started skin diving along the East Coast in 1955. Back then, kelp forests were thick and tall and plentiful. When I stopped diving about 1990, the kelp had diminished or pretty much disappeared. Where did it go? John, well, Megan, you were talking about that in Tasmania, but kelp forests, I mean, Tasmania's got the best examples of giant kelp, hasn't it? But there are others as well. Have they all disappeared for similar reasons, Megan?
There's a pretty common story like that we see around the world of loss of kelp being driven by these like boom and bust dynamics of sea urchins, overgrazing, and those dynamics in turn are caused in often times by human activities, whether or not it's removing the predators of the sea urchins or kind of changing kind of environmental conditions. I share that same perspective in that I really fell in love with kelp beds in Canada where I grew up and really experienced them declining as well. And I think that really drove me in this career in terms of wanting to do the science to help underpin decision making for how we rebuild marine life. And it really is possible, definitely on small scales, to make really positive impacts.
Mm. Fernanda, just back to you on this issue of the economic values we place on the natural environment. A lot of people argue this. They say, look, unless you can put a value on it, unless you can say this is the cost to you if you don't do something, then you're not going to get corporations and industry to comply. Are there dangers to this, looking at the whole of our ecosystems through just a financial lens?
Look, I first of all, I personally don't share it. Like I would think, and I think most people that work in the environment and, you know, and a lot of people that really love nature would just say, well, it's pretty obvious we have to look after them.
Yeah.
So I personally do not share that view that it has to have an economic value. But I do notice that we have been for the last 100 years just destroying our environment. And because it didn't have an economic value, or well, it did have, but it wasn't really recognized. So what are the, so I think we should give it a go. We should give it a go and see if this works, because I have experience, I'm from Mexico, so I have experienced small, going to really small rural lands that had amazing nature. They have clean water, they have mangrove seagrasses that no one is paying them to protect. They don't receive any benefits from looking after this land. And I also think that's not fair. And these people, they might not have jobs because if their job is fishing and they want to respect the times when they shouldn't fish, that costs them money. But then they're not receiving money from anyone to protect these places. So in that perspective that I have, I do think that it's also fair that the people that do the right thing and protect these places and restore them should also be economically benefit from them.
Yeah. No, I get that. Michael, back to you on knowledge and data and how much we know. How well is the Australian coastline understood? Is it ecologically mapped in any meaningful way where we know pretty much what's going on in most parts of it?
Yeah, I mean, Australia's got a really good group of marine scientists and always has. We've sort of been, I'd argue, world leaders in many respects. And it depends on which of the habitats you're talking about. So, you know, we know a lot about coral reefs.
We know.
There's a lot of research on
coral reefs. Through Charlie Veron onwards, hey?
Yes, correct. And then some other habitat types like mangroves, for example, have been mapped. Their distribution have been mapped globally at a very fine scale. And that's because, one, they're not submerged, so you can see them from satellites, and then you can do that sort of processing. Other ecosystems like seagrass and macroalgae forests, you can't see them all the time from satellites. So we know a lot less about the distribution of these. We've just started a program that's looking at the biodiversity of tropical shellfish reefs in Australia, and we know almost nothing about shellfish reefs in the tropical north of Australia. So It depends on the ecosystem type, basically. So some are well-known and some are very poorly known.
Yeah. Just out in your neck of the woods, Megan, you know, scallop beds and other oyster and marine crustaceans are not, we don't well under, well, do we understand well enough the impacts that fishing and other predations have on them?
So in southern Australia, there used to be vast, vast beds of shellfish like oysters. And when European colonists arrived in this country, it was this really huge resource for for food, but also for using the shells in construction and other types of activities. This in combination with clearing and catchment, which increases the runoff of sediments and nutrients down into the ocean and also pollutants, led to the die-off of shellfish around Australia, about 90%. So we do, there is a lot of interest in restoring these habitats, primarily for the role that they play in filtering water and also in supporting fish. So like there's examples from the United States where you have restored shellfish reefs. They give a really big boost to recreational fishing and to the economy that's related.
How do you do that? How would you reintroduce a shellfish reef?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when removal of shellfish reefs, you get like the seafloor becomes kind of softer and muddier. So to get the right structure back in place, the groups that are doing this, and Michael mentioned the Nature Conservancy is a leader in this space, first involves bringing big kind of hard, like concrete blocks back onto the seafloor.
Okay.
Sometimes the shellfish can recruit naturally. Sometimes they might actually need to transplant some or add some seeded oysters on top of that.
Okay, but this works. I mean, this idea of artificial reefs then, I mean, it does, in general, it does work.
It can work, yeah, it can work really well.
1-300-800-222 is the number. We're talking about the precious, precious resource we have and the need to collaborate and coordinate. And judging from our conversation tonight, with the different stakeholders and governments and projects going on, there is an awful lot of coordination that is needed. I do thank you for your time, all three of you. Dr. Michael Sivers has been with us from Griffith University. He's a marine ecologist there. Dr. Megan Saunders from the CSIRO in Hobart, the senior research scientist there. And Dr. Fernanda Adame, associate professor at Griffith University. Fernanda, thank you for your time. Megan, thank you for your time. Michael, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thanks, Philip. Thank you. It's an important, important topic, and one that I think if we all need to get behind and help, we all know what, well, we sense what the problems are, and these are the sorts of experts who can help us.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.